creationists who are also selling a point of view. Having recognized the virtues of technological promotion, we can also see how innovation can sometimes undermine itself. The extravagant expected returns on investments in so-called unicorns, billion-dollar companies like Uber still losing money before going public, are competing for capital with market-creating innovation, to use Clayton Christensen's phrase, that could not only reduce costs but create jobs. We have seen that excessive efficiency can lead to shadow work and efficiency-sapping fatigue. Electronic medical records, while a welcome alternative to the perils of notoriously illegible handwriting, have imposed more rather than less clerical work on physicians. Newspaper publishers lay off actual writers but hire staff to promote reader engagement and decipher social media algorithms. Meanwhile, social media sites are torn between charges of bias against human curators versus protests over misinformation when algorithms alone decide. The substitution of data points for the physical presence of people creates inefficiencies of its own. Without constant practice, if only on simulators, automated control tends to degrade operator skills over time. An alarming prospect, since self-driving automobile networks will never be immune from the hacking and denial-of-service attacks that are endemic to the Internet of Things. Medicine reduced to tests and measurements ignores the benefits of the touch of physicians. Even without multitasking and email, a classroom dominated by students' devices may be less efficient for learning than a traditional one. In fact, Silicon Valley itself has become one of the world's most expensive places for housing because its corporations still believe that physical presence and interaction are more efficient in collaborative work, even if a growing number of workers are arranging telecommuting. Apple has spent $5 billion on its new 12,000-employee Circular Headquarters Campus 2 in Cupertino to inspire staff members with the aesthetic vision of the company's leader, Steve Jobs. In the words of the company's design head, Jonathan Ive, it is a building where so many people can connect and collaborate and walk and talk. Despite all its technical and environmental innovations, the structure's reversion to the self-contained ideal of 20th-century corporate technology complexes led the Los Angeles Times architecture critic to call it a retrograde cocoon. In May 2017, IBM reacted to declining earnings by abruptly ending the liberal telework policies that it had not only practiced but recommended to other companies. An unspecified number of its 360,000 employees were notified to move to a work center, apply for a new IBM position, or resign. Whether or not Apple's new building will engender a fresh burst of creativity, whether or not IBM's ultimatum will make the company newly competitive, both moves reflect a revival of face-to-face thinking and new misgivings about virtual presence. The major current dream of Silicon Valley, the autonomous car that does not need driver attention, could, if successful, make the driver a more engaged observer of his or her surroundings, as we heard in Chapter 4. Yet Ford Motor Company has patented a movie screen covering the windshield, protecting the driver from any visual contact with other vehicles or life along the road, a kind of Plato's cave on wheels. Ford's CEO has declared that his corporation is metamorphosing from an auto company to an auto and a mobility company. Ford vehicles, he assures us, will be able to use analytics to anticipate people's needs, as opposed to people trying to tell us what they want. Among those needs may be orders from Amazon, Ford's partner in artificial intelligence. So when not watching movies, we'll be able to buy what Amazon's algorithms have decided we desire. Evidently, even the ancient philosophical aphorism, know thyself, is now ripe for outsourcing. Fortunately, we do not have to choose between digital and analog lifestyles. Even in Silicon Valley, people are not doing so. I doubt that many of its gourmet corporate cafeterias proudly serve genetically modified cuisine. Many information technology professionals' children, as we have seen, attend schools that offer spirituality rather than a head start in coding. High school and college students may not buy or read printed newspapers, but much of the news they do read online is made possible by the remaining print news market. The ratio of electronic to print books appears to be stabilizing. The U.S. Navy is reviving instruction in celestial navigation and use of the sextant. Technology journalists are often closer to their high-level industry sources than to technical people in the trenches or to their pragmatic fellow citizens outside the media. Balancing algorithm and intuition to achieve inspired inefficiency needs six strategies. First is the Perfect Five concept developed by David Mendel, citing the work of his joint thesis advisor and colleague in aeronautical and astronautical engineering, Tom Sheridan. Sheridan, who had studied behavioral psychology with B.F. Skinner and analyzed the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant meltdown, originated the idea of the spectrum of automation, from the purely human to the entirely robotic. If the scale runs from 1 to 10, Mendel, like Sheridan, believes the optimum is at 5 in the middle. Turning all decisions over to a completely automated system means not eliminating human error, but unleashing the inevitable bugs that engineers and programmers unavoidably introduce into their design despite the most diligent efforts. Automation works best under the control of well-prepared human operators, on the model of NASA astronauts in the Apollo program, who deliberately were given extensive powers over Apollo's onboard computer. The principle has not changed even after more than half a century. Not only for vehicles, but for all other systems controlled by algorithms, a caveat from a 2012 Department of Defense report applies. There are no fully autonomous systems, just as there are no fully autonomous soldiers, sailors, airmen, or marines. It seems more efficient to make processes autonomous rather than to recruit and train skilled people, whether truck drivers or editors, but in the long run, the robot and the human are best able to correct each other's weaknesses. One foundation of the Perfect Five strategy is the underrated resources of our own minds. The new efficiency movement often cites research on human irrationality in decision-making to support the outsourcing of thought to algorithms. But as the sociologist Harry Collins showed in his book Artificial Experts, we all have an immense fund of tacit knowledge about the real world that can never be programmed into a computer, as chess openings, for example, can. It is doubtful that even IBM's Watson, with its vast databases and multiple algorithms, can interpret the meaning of a proverb not already explained in its memory as a first-grade schoolchild probably could just on the basis of experience in his or her short life. Tacit knowledge, especially anticipation of human feelings and reactions, helps us respond creatively to unfamiliar challenges. As Collins put it, we know more than we can say, because we have learned from social interactions, not just from the kinds of instructions that are programmed into devices. A corollary is that even machine learning is not like human learning, because it occurs outside social interaction. Our intuitions also draw on a capacity for unconscious understanding more flexible than machine logic. In the words of Gerd Gigerenzer, often what looks like a reasoning error from a purely logical perspective turns out to be a highly intelligent social judgment in the real world. Relying on our intuition does not mean surrendering to it unchecked. To the contrary, Electronic memory, algorithms, and automated decision-making may free us for more creative activities, as pioneers of computer science like Norbert Wiener advocated in the 1950s. As the mathematician-philosopher Alfred North Whitehead foresaw as early as 1911, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. Second of the six strategies for balance is physical presence. Face-to-face communication is usually less efficient than electronic exchanges in terms of time spent, but it offers a far more efficient way to convey shades of meaning, gauge responses, and adjust words to avoid misunderstandings and reach agreements. That is why technology companies are, as we have just heard, still investing in offices designed to foster both collaboration and creativity. Emoji are a visually intriguing but limited way to convey the same nuances. While there is a place for video and telephone medicine, there is no substitute for the presence of a patient. In education, the most crucial resource is still not information technologies, but enthusiastic teachers trained to engage students in classrooms. Finland's school reform yielded some of the highest scores on international tests, yet Finland has largely avoided testing, ranking, and tracking. This style of teaching is labor-intensive. Teaching is treated as the equivalent of the legal and medical professions, with high salaries, and is a coveted choice. As a result, Finland has become far more competitive economically in the half-century since its school reforms, by not being obsessed with measurement and competitiveness. Part of physical presence is the sense of terrain, the mapping of people and objects in real space. Think of the difference between a supermarket or specialty store and a catalog or website, or between GPS directions and a paper map, and in turn between a printed map and actual presence in a place. A printed book is a kind of terrain, the paragraphs of each page and illustrations having their own shape. In medicine, a patient's body, as opposed to data, is also terrain that complements other information. Geographers and cognitive psychologists have long recognized the importance of the mental maps we make. There is even special software to diagram ideas and products. Because of the limits to practical monitor size, there is still no substitute for an old-fashioned storyboard with pushpins and cards for an overview of large projects and coordination of complex schedules. Even the comedy film editor Brent White, who has four large monitors at the workstation in his studio, used a storyboard for an overview of the scenes in the film Spy that he edited with the latest electronic equipment and software. Of course, there is no law that a physical representation is better to work with than a virtual one. In chess, there seems to be no evidence that either beginners or experts play better with three-dimensional pieces on a board or with virtual boards on computer screens. There is no doubt, though, that if playing through the master games is the only way to proficiency, reviewing them with computer software packs more practice into less time than old-style moves on a three-dimensional board, and is thus more genuinely efficient. Physical presence also applies to economic life. The rationale of Amazon's acquisition of the Whole Foods supermarket chain in June 2017 is still unfolding, but at least part of it seems related to its decision to open its own unorthodox style of retail bookstore. A bricks-and-mortar store is also a laboratory of consumer behavior that complements the massive data of online shopping habits. Another measure of the persistence of the physical is resistance to the idea of the cashless society. The threat of this movement, which has gained support in Europe and India as a way to combat crime, is not only that even more theft and fraud will be electronic. It is not even the obvious danger to privacy, It is rather an even more serious issue of personal data that might be called asymmetric efficiency. Even without prying into individuals' lives, the owners of proprietary databases and software know far more about our aggregate behavior than they publish. We have some techniques of our own, like price and fare tracking software, but consumers and even academic researchers are like club players trying to defeat supercomputers. While cash, like electronic funds systems, can be abused, it also helps reduce the imbalance between big data and little people. The third strategy for balance is creative waste. Regarding loss, Silicon Valley has a mind divided against itself. It celebrates the positive role of failure and how insights from it can lead to ultimate success. But it also promotes the idea that algorithms, especially enhanced by machine learning, can approach perfection just as computers have prevailed in games, even though the reality of most human enterprises is far more complex than games on a limited board with well-defined rules. Hollywood studios may not have used artificial intelligence algorithms to program their films in the early 2010s, but they did expect that a small number of big-budget blockbuster sequels featuring familiar stars and plot lines would sustain them. A Harvard Business School professor, Linda Elbers, championed this strategy. But by the summer of 2016, some of the largest studios were reporting declining or non-existent profits, and the $150 million Ben-Hur sequel failed to earn a tenth of its production cost. Recalling a warning of the doyen of directors, the anthropologist of mass culture, Grant McCracken, concluded Spielberg 1, Harvard 0. That might be an exaggeration. In the long term, Elbers may indeed be correct that blockbusters are the main drivers of profit in today's environment. And her work has rightly dampened enthusiasm for Chris Anderson's long tail of individually modest but collectively profitable sales. The real problem is that blockbuster economics stands in the way of experimentation, which can be a source of future blockbusters. Steven Spielberg had called for new paradigms, yet these usually can be discovered only by the inefficient process of trial and error. Algorithms for predicting fiction and non-fiction bestsellers based on big data on readers' habits have also appeared and present the same problem. By efficiently identifying what has worked in the past and fostering more of it, they are courting consumer fatigue. Of course, human acquisition editors, as I once was, often stay with the familiar too, which is why some of the greatest commercial successes, most recently J.K. Rowling's original Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, were rejected by a dozen or more houses. The strength of intuitive decision-making is not in the gifts of any single editor, but in the variety of outlook and tastes across publishing as a whole, corporate and independent. It has, on balance, recognized talent efficiently as a system, as opposed to individual editors' judgments, in part because it is inevitably wasteful. In Chapter 2, we heard that competition for citations and for publication in so-called high-impact journals had a chilling effect on innovation, no matter how much lip service is paid to it. The peer review of grant approval makes it difficult for a dissenting proposal to be approved. It is efficient to go with established laboratories and lines of research rather than dissenters who are likely to fail. The fourth strategy is analog serendipity. The web originally was digitally serendipitous, offering hyperlinks that could branch in unexpected directions. In the 21st century, the rise of mobile computing with its smaller screens and influence of social media tailored web use more to individual tastes while risking the creation of filter bubbles of like-minded comment. The better the algorithms of platform companies become, the more tailored to the user's existing patterns of browsing, and the lower the chances of productive surprises, even if most people see more diverse sources of information than the filter bubble hypothesis implies. As we heard in Chapter 2, some programs have been designed to foster serendipity, and there are apps that deliver articles curated in a serendipitous spirit. Analog media have more than an aesthetic appeal. Because they are not just screen representations, but occupy three-dimensional space, they access our imagination in ways that digital media can complement but never completely replace. Just as digital media uniquely lend themselves to efficient search and quantitative analysis. Print information on too large a scale is unwieldy. When I had a fellowship in Washington, I sometimes thought of applying for a pass to use the Library of Congress stacks, but realized that the number of volumes and the distance between volumes would defeat serendipity. At the other extreme, the collections of the historical seminar, when I was a visiting scholar at the University of Heidelberg, contained a carefully selected library of non-circulating standard and current works, eminently browsable. The 52,000-volume reference collection of the New York Public Library's Rose Main Reading Room includes not just encyclopedias and dictionaries, but standard scholarly works. High school and college teachers should take heart from students' continued recognition of the value of print textbooks, as we heard in Chapter 3. As Anne E. Michael, a college writing teacher who encourages students to explore older print resources, has noted, the stacks can be unexpected sources of inspiration. The poet Stanley Kunitz said his life was changed by finding a book of Gerard Manley Hopkins's poems in his college library while looking for a thesis topic and encountering God's grandeur in this volume that he had picked at random. Silicon Valley executives and researchers, aware of the serendipity issue, have taken steps to design for productive accidental encounters. To some, the idea of engineered serendipity may be an oxymoron, like studied sincerity. Yet the moguls themselves do not seem to get the idea. In an interview with Time magazine on the occasion of his winning Person of the Year, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, praised serendipity as an awesome force, but went on to define it as the recognition of what we already know. No longer, he explained, will we miss seeing friends who happen to be at the opposite corner of a restaurant. Indeed, since then, Facebook has been able to show consenting contacts real-time locations. But I suspect that for most people, serendipity means either rediscovering in person an old friend or acquaintance who is probably not a Facebook friend, or becoming friends with a stranger at the next table. In Chapter 4, we encountered Eric Schmidt's vision of a context-sensitive smartphone guidebook that could tell us all about the background of a city. But what of surprises that are not in the GPS database, which will probably be cluttered by advertising? Managed and domesticated serendipity, so far, is a hollow representation of the real thing. Fifth is desirable difficulty, which we encountered in Chapter 3. It is not just that we learn more by taking handwritten notes than by using a device with a keyboard, or that slightly harder-to-read fonts promote comprehension. It is also that sometimes an inefficient connection results in our assimilating information more efficiently. The psychologist Adrian Ward found that simulating a slow web connection made students more likely to consider new information critically during searches instead of regarding it as something they already knew. There is even a slow web movement seeking a return to the deliberative speed of the obsolescent dial-up modem. While I don't consider that era a golden age, the feeling is still worth experiencing. As I noted in Chapter 4 about the view from European ultra-high-speed trains, or for that matter, the taste of steel-cut slow-cooking Irish oatmeal, as opposed to its mass-market rolled counterpart. In general, We may appreciate something more deeply when we get it less conveniently, and thus get more for our money. There are other reasons too, of course. Even more than 90 years after the great inflation of the 1920s, Germans still prefer paying with cash to using credit cards, if only to protect privacy and avoid overspending. Thrift can be an important form of efficiency. But even for credit card spenders, inefficiency can actually help us enjoy our purchases more. Silicon Valley, true to the friction-free creed, is constantly finding new ways to shorten delivery times, whether through more automated distribution centers or through experimental technology like robots and drones. Amazon's Echo Home speaker is a triumph of artificial intelligence, not only playing music on request, but making possible ordering by a simple command using the company's Alexa voice service, an idea that must appall traditionalist Germans. But it is not necessary to reject electronic commerce to see an advantage in delayed delivery. Social psychologists have found that people interpret longer delivery times as reduction of their ultimate enjoyment of a product, which is why Amazon's one-click ordering feature and its Prime program, guaranteeing free two-day delivery for many of its items in return for an annual membership fee, have been so popular. Most purchases are not urgent, though. It turns out that waiting makes using the product more enjoyable, according to other psychological experiments. There is a positive value in anticipation. The catch is that the next time they order, people generally do not remember how waiting enhanced their enjoyment, just as students might not be aware of how writing rather than typing notes on a laptop keyboard helped their understanding. Consumers don't learn the benefits of deferred enjoyment, and vendors have no incentive to teach them. But most people who have been on a long waiting list for a product or experience they have really wanted probably will recall some excitement of expectation. Buyers of bespoke luxury products or of custom-built houses might become impatient, but it is more likely that they will see the delay as further evidence of the quality of their purchase. The sixth and final strategy, as we heard in Chapter 3, is cognitive bootstrapping. The more one knows about something, the more powerful the algorithms of search engines can be. We can recognize from a list of results the sources that we know from experience are most reliable and discard others that the software has promoted. Repeated practice lets us distinguish serious from fake facts and lets us identify contrasting opinions and their advocates. Bootstrapping is the art of learning to begin with one query and using the results to find new and more precise search terms. It would be better, as I suggested in Chapter 2, if search engines could be programmed to be more selective. In fact, they already can, but this slower search would take more time for the user, accustomed to almost instantaneous answers, and more processing expense for the search engine provider. Bootstrapping is a more economical alternative, using options that search engines already have built into them. For example, limiting searches to generic top-level domains like .gov, .edu, and .org, which may initially exclude some excellent sites and include dubious ones, but helps find more academically authoritative ones if scientific credentials are important. As in other activities, it is only in deliberate practice, analyzing our last search for information and looking for ways to improve it, that we can develop expertise. The new challenge of the digital world is the illusion that we can outsource our skills and judgment to algorithms. The founders of Silicon Valley did not think that way. Originally, most properly saw computing as a means to relieve people of repetitive and mind-numbing tasks, to exercise uniquely human creativity. The web's original hypertext was serendipity incarnate. In the early 21st century, that dream is not dead, but it is fading. just as economic inequality has been growing, in part because of the effects of new technology, the price gap between entry-level mobile devices and desktop computers designed for professional and semi-professional content creation has been widening, even if high-end smartphones cost more than low-end laptops. If the web is to achieve its promise, inspired inefficiency implies a critical view of all its convenient results, especially search engine queries and social media feeds. Some social scientists and popular writers have seized on popular irrationality, supposed indifference to facts, and uncritical acceptance of partisan statements. Yet elites are in no position to look down on anybody. Historically, in the 20th century, some of the best educated people in the United States and Europe were seduced by Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler. Stage magicians who earn their livelihoods fooling people claim that brilliant audiences are the easiest to deceive. The playing card wizard and historian of magic, Ricky Jay, told the writer Paul Hoffman that the ideal believers would be Nobel laureates because the egos of brilliant people make them feel impervious to deception. Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller explained that brilliant scientists are used to accepting counterintuitive ideas like black holes and string theory. Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme fooled not only highly sophisticated elite investors, but many respected investment advisors. One of his victims, Stephen Greenspan, was a professor of psychology specializing in gullibility. I have found that academic friends at the top of their fields, while not gullible, never needed to acquire the general search skills that I was compelled to develop as an editor and writer. In fact, even in the 1980s, at the dawn of end-user electronic databases in libraries, one prominent social scientist had never heard of the standard electronic bibliography in his field, probably because he did not need it. He knew the colleagues, journals, and papers necessary in his own work. Cognitive bootstrapping through search is a skill that can and should be taught, but that, like music and sports, needs hours of practice. With enough experience, a search intuition can begin to form. Reference librarians become information athletes who find ways to elusive sources using a variety of search terms, limits, and other techniques. Teachers at all levels, from elementary school to graduate school, as well as librarians, have an exceptional opportunity to show a new generation why too much efficiency can be inefficient, and why more skilled effort can, in the long run, be more efficient. Just as singers are taught optimal ways to breathe, even though most normal breathing is unconscious. Even if schools and colleges, faced with so many financial and curricular pressures, do not create new programs for search, it is a skill that individuals can develop on their own through practice and through use of resources provided by Google and other search engine companies. The right kind of search, not always the most efficient in the short run, can improve investments, purchases, travel, and health decisions. I hope this book has shown how new and old technologies alike can be right for some uses and wrong for others. It is an obvious point, but we sometimes need to be reminded of the obvious. Utopianism and dystopianism are useful together in imagining futures, but unsatisfactory as programs. Analog experience can enhance digital efficacy. Digital tools can improve analog access. We don't have to choose between the two. We should choose not to choose. This is Jason Culp. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Efficiency Paradox, What Big Data Can't Do, by Edward Tenner. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Linda Korn. Text copyright 2018 by Edward Tenner. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.